Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcasts at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast or a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from NHK Japan, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, Russia's Sputnik Radio, and Radio Havana, Cuba. We will begin with NHK World Radio Japan. This weekend, people in Taiwan are voting on maintaining a ban on U.S. pork because it contains ractopamine, a leanness-enhancing substance banned in 160 countries, including China and the European Union. Foreign ministers at the G7 meeting agreed that China is using coercive economic policies. Australia and South Korea struck a defense supply deal and boosted military cooperation. The new $768 billion U.S. defense bill includes $7 billion for deterrence in the Indo-Pacific region and $300 million to support the Ukrainian military. The U.S. Defense Department ruled that the drone strike, which killed 10 civilians in Afghanistan, requires no accountability. The treated radioactive wastewater from the Fukushima nuclear power plant will be discharged into the Pacific Ocean through a tunnel in the seabed. The number of COVID cases in Japan remains relatively low. NHK Japan.
People in Taiwan will vote this weekend on whether to reinstate a ban on imports of pork. This is one of 4 proposals that will be put to the public in a referendum on Saturday. The ban effectively targets pork from the United States. President Tsai Ing-wen's administration eased restrictions in January on imports of pork containing the leanness-enhancing additive ractopamine. The administration said import restrictions should be scrapped if the pork meets international standards in order to conclude a trade deal with the U.S. Tsai told a rally on Saturday that the issue also concerns whether Taiwan will be able to join the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership known as CPTPP.
Imports of U.S. pork must be allowed if they meet international standards. By doing so, the world trusts Taiwan and supports our participation in the international organization.
Taiwan's main opposition party, the Kuomintang, proposed the referendum. It is urging the government to reinstate the restrictions, citing food safety as a major reason. Party leader Eric Chu and supporters marched in Taipei on Sunday to rally support.
This is not for party interests. Not only young people of our party, but all young people in Taiwan will suffer health damage from pork that has additives if the imports continue.
Polls show supporters of the ban outnumber opponents. Foreign ministers from the Group of 7 nations emerged from a weekend meeting united against economic tactics used by China.
We are concerned about the coercive economic policies of China. And what we want to do is build the investment reach, the economic trade reach of like-minded, freedom-loving democracies.
China has long worked to increase its influence on developing nations through trade and large loans. The ministers also noted concerns over China's movements in the East and South China Seas. They invited counterparts from the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, Australia and South Korea to the meeting for the first time. The chair's statement said participants discussed the importance of maintaining a free and open Indo-Pacific, which is inclusive and based on the rule of law. The G7 foreign ministers also released a joint statement on heightened military tensions along the border between Russia and Ukraine. Moscow has amassed a large number of troops there. The ministers say they are united in their condemnation of Russia's military buildup and aggressive rhetoric. It says the ministers call on Russia to de-escalate, pursue diplomatic channels, and abide by its international commitments.
The leaders of Australia and South Korea have struck a defense deal worth over $700 million. The countries are boosting military cooperation amid China's increasing maritime activities in the Indo-Pacific. Prime Minister Scott Morrison and President Moon Jae-in attended Monday's signing ceremony in Canberra. The deal is said to be Australia's biggest ever defense contract with an Asian nation. Under the agreement, a South Korean defense company will provide Australia with artillery weapons, supply vehicles, and radars.
It's an important further chapter in the defense industry story for Australia as we continue to build our sovereign capability. And Korea is an important partner in that journey.
Moon said South Korea and Australia have a similar geopolitical outlook, but he stressed his visit had nothing to do with his country's relationship with China. The agreement comes as Australia is stepping up security cooperation in the Indo-Pacific. That includes membership in the Quad and AUKUS alliances.
The U.S. Senate has passed a $768 billion defense bill. This includes $7 billion for a deterrence initiative in the Indo-Pacific region. The outlay is more than triple the amount allocated in the previous fiscal year. The deterrence initiative is aimed at countering China's military buildup. The Senate voted overwhelmingly for the bill, which lays out defense spending for fiscal 2022. It includes a statement of congressional support for the defense of Taiwan. The bill bans the Department of Defense from buying products produced with forced labor in China's Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region. The bill also includes $300 million to support Ukraine's military amid escalating tensions with Russia, as well as $4 billion to boost defense initiatives in Europe. The legislation has already passed the House of Representatives and now goes to President Joe Biden to sign.
Staying with the United States, Defense Department officials have closed their review of a U.S. military drone strike in Afghanistan that killed 10 civilians. They say none of the troops involved will face disciplinary action. The strike took place in Kabul on August 29th. Military personnel thought they were eliminating the threat of an extremist attack. Instead, 10 civilians lost their lives, including 7 children. The U.S. admitted to the mistake and apologized. Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby spoke to reporters on Monday.
I do not anticipate there being issues of personal accountability to be had with respect to the August 29th airstrike.
In the Pentagon's review of the attack, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin asked 2 combatant commanders to make recommendations for improvements. Kirby says none of the recommendations Austin accepted dealt with accountability. U.S. media say the decision has left relatives of the victims in shock. The operator of the crippled Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant has begun tests of the seabed before building an undersea tunnel to release treated water from the facility. The water was originally used to cool molten nuclear fuel and was contaminated with radioactive materials. It mixed with rain and groundwater seeping into damaged reactor buildings. It's since been treated and stored in tanks, but still contains radioactive tritium. The facility has more than 1,000 tanks for such water. These are expected to reach capacity after autumn next year. Across Japan, authorities confirmed 144 coronavirus cases on Tuesday. There was 1 death. Tokyo reported 24 new cases. The daily tally in the capital has been below 30 for almost 5 weeks.
Those reports were from NHK Radio Japan. They are now heard from 8:30 to 9 p.m. at 7245 and 9865 or on the web at www.nhk.or.jp. All the times I announce are for Pacific Standard Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. Next, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. Brief COVID and vaccine reports from Europe, South Korea, and New Zealand. Countries involved agree in principle to end the Korean War. The Philippines were hit with a super typhoon, and scientists have confirmed last summer's record temperatures in the Arctic and the Antarctic. The Russian and Chinese leaders held a video summit. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
Many parts of Europe are facing a surge in new coronavirus infections and hospitalizations. Governments are pushing unvaccinated people to get their shots as soon as possible, but vaccination rates across the continent still vary greatly. Let's take a look. Leading the pack is Portugal, where 88% of the population is fully vaccinated, and Spain is also doing well at 80%. Germany, just 69% of the population is fully vaccinated. That's a relatively low rate compared with the rest of Western Europe. But much of Eastern Europe is at even lower end of the scale, with countries such as Croatia, Slovakia and Romania having vaccinated less than 50% of the population. But the lowest vaccination rate in the EU is in Bulgaria, at just over 26%.
France has announced tighter controls on travel to and from Britain in response to the rapid spread of the Omicron variant there. From midnight on Saturday, people arriving in France from the UK will be required to self-isolate for 7 days. That'll reduce to 48 hours if tests prove negative. On Wednesday, the UK recorded its highest ever daily number of cases, more than 78,000. That's the highest number in Europe. Worldwide, the UK second only to the US with the total number of new infections.
Now for a breakdown of some pandemic developments elsewhere in the world. South Korea has authorized its toughest pandemic restrictions to date. Starting Saturday, private gatherings will be limited to 5 people. Schools will go back to remote learning and restaurants will close by 9 p.m. And here in Germany, there are plans to buy 92 million vaccine doses for the new year. The announcement comes after the new health minister warned of a jab shortage in the first quarter of 2022. New Zealand says 90% of its eligible population is now fully inoculated. The nation's health regulator has also granted provisional approval for the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine for 5 to 11-year-olds.
South Korean President Moon Jae-in says the United States, China, and North Korea have agreed in principle to declare a formal end to the Korean War. He says the declaration will help revive peace talks with North Korea. The countries are technically still at war. No peace deal was reached back in 1953.
Tens of thousands of people in the Philippines are being moved to safety as Super Typhoon Rai makes landfall. Authorities are warning of flash floods, landslides and tidal surges, and scores of flights have been cancelled. Experts say climate change is making typhoons stronger and more unpredictable.
Scientists in Siberia have confirmed the highest ever recorded temperature in the Arctic. That's 38 degrees Celsius or 100 degrees Fahrenheit. And the United Nations says it's a massive alarm bell in the climate crisis.
Welcome to the Pole of Cold. Verkhoyansk in Russia is supposed to be one of the coldest inhabited places on Earth. But last summer, as these images show, it set a different record. 38 degrees Celsius, the highest temperature ever measured in the Arctic.
The heat that we saw in Siberia in 2020 would have been almost impossible without climate change. The Arctic, as WMO keeps saying, is one of the fastest warming parts of the world. It's warming more than twice as fast as the global average.
And with the heat came the drought. Even the waterlogged vastness of Siberia burned. This year, according to NASA, smoke from the Siberian wildfires reached the North Pole for the first time in recorded history. And every acre that burns releases more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. But that wasn't the only alarming temperature record announced by the UN. This one was recorded on the other side of the globe.
last year also there was a new temperature record in the Antarctic continent of 18.3 degrees Celsius. That was recorded at an Argentinian base called Esperanza.
And that's not all that's happening in Antarctica. Scientists monitoring the Thwaites Glacier, which is the size of Great Britain, say it's melting so fast that it's dumping 50 billion tons of ice into the ocean each year. The dramatic acceleration of this melting will lead to the glacier's rapid retreat and could cause its eventual collapse.
Russian President Vladimir Putin and his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping have held a video summit. Topics on the agenda included increasing tensions with the European Union and the United States. This was their second call this year.
Those reports were from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com, as well as on YouTube at their channel called DW News. Next, Sputnik Radio. On his program called Going Underground, Afshin Ratansi interviewed Professor Richard Sakwa from the University of Kent. They discussed the summit between Putin and Biden over the Ukraine crises, the unresolved issues at the end of the first Cold War that led to the second Cold War between the U.S. and Russia, NATO expansion towards Russia's borders contrary to promises made prior to the collapse of the Soviet Union, and the threat of nuclear war. Russia's Sputnik Radio.
Joining me now from Canterbury is Kent University's Professor of Russian and European Politics and the author of The Putin Paradox, Professor Richard Sakwa. What do you think of the virtual Putin-Biden summit this week?
I think the big picture is that the idea was that they would stabilize relations with Russia and then focus on the conflict with China. You talked about 57 years ago, the so-called Cold War. It was the Cold War. And of course,
I meant so-called because it was hot for many of the developing world and the global South.
Oh, in that sense, absolutely. In that sense, it was pretty hot in all sorts of places. Of course, the Vietnam War, etc. But it was ultimately a Cold War in that the major powers did not come into direct confrontation. I argue that that was indeed Cold War One, and that we're now in Cold War Two because of the unresolved issues at the end of the first Cold War after 1989-91. And of course, that's how we need to understand the Ukraine crisis today in that context, because no inclusive, equitable peace order was established after 1991, and instead of which the Atlantic power system, NATO, and of course the European Union both advanced. And in a sense, it wasn't so much the enlargement of these two organizations, it is the way it was done, which has established a negative security dilemma, or let's put it this way, an intensifying security dilemma in which Russia feels more and more challenged. And this is what the crisis over Ukraine today is all about.
Do you see it as part of Cold War II that we should have at least one U.S. politician, Senator Roger Wicker, second highest ranking Republican on the Armed Services Committee in Congress, saying that we mustn't rule out a first use nuclear strike on Russia?
This is just that sort of crazy talk. It's just a sign of just how weird and how dangerous the second Cold War is, because I don't think you'd have had many people talking in such a loose and wild manner in Cold War One, which was a more disciplined conflict, a more straightforward one, communism versus capitalism, two power blocks. It seemed to be so much simpler, almost naive in those days. This second Cold War, you're absolutely right that, you know, defenders of NATO enlargement will argue that it's benign and that there's nothing for Russia to be concerned about. Now, you know, I've always suggested that is, you know, that's a valid argument. There's absolutely no reason why NATO could not have enlarged. But the point was that ultimately there had to be a way in which the enlargement dealt with the Russia security question. Now, it's not a question of Putin. It's not a question of, you know, whoever comes after him, because it also concerned who came before him, Yeltsin and Medvedev, and, of course, whoever comes after him.
the pouring of Western arms and troops. I mean, I don't know why there are. The U.S. National Guard troops from California are already in Ukraine. British troops apparently on standby to send 600 special forces. How did Putin get into a position like this, forgetting the errors made by Gorbachev and Yeltsin?
Yes, indeed. I mean, clearly, this standoff at the moment, it's as dangerous as the Cuban Missile Crisis in October 1962. This is the second time this year that there's been this military build-up by Russia. Of course, you mentioned one figure. We don't know what the figures are. They seem to veer between 70,000 and 120, if not 150,000. But certainly, there are forces along the border.
Are you suspicious of the sourcing that we're hearing daily in NATO nation media about numbers of troops and munitions and personnel and materiel?
Yes. I mean, these numbers, as you say, keep changing. And don't forget, the whole issue began in Washington. At first, the Kiev leadership dismissed it. Only then they've now joined it. You know, I'm talking about a few weeks ago. It's a very interesting moment. Can I just say one word about the Sevastopol base? It isn't just a question of NATO enlargement, of course, because even NATO enlargement was off the agenda at the time of the Obama presidency. Yet we're talking about the fact that the U.S. forces will be advancing into Ukraine already. And this is Putin made this point in his Valdai speech in October. And, of course, he's not the only one to have pointed out that NATO enlargement is only one part of the advancement of an Atlantic power system which excludes Russia. So, as I say, you know, what's happening now is that Russia's pushing back. In his State of the Nation speech earlier this year, Putin argued this was in April. He talked about red lines. And so what's happening now is quite clearly the Ukrainian crisis is in an impasse. And and this is why I'm going to say it was positive that in the Biden-Putin virtual meeting earlier this week, that this was talked about.
Biden said no red lines. Biden will not accept red lines.
They won't accept these red lines. But Putin, whether they accept them or not, there are some. And the question is, that what does Russia do about it? Clearly, invasion talk, I think, is wild talk. There's Russia is not planning to invade.
Professor Richard Sagwa, thank you.
That excerpted interview is by Afshin Ratansi from his program called Going Underground on Sputnik Radio, the current name for the Voice of Russia, available at rt.com and on YouTube. Search for Going Underground. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could assist me by supporting this listener-funded program, I may be reached through the website and PayPal or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California 95490. Please help me continue producing this weekly show, which I freely distribute to radio stations and the Internet. We will conclude with Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuban President Díaz-Canel said that the U.S. lacks the moral authority to judge and decide on democracy based on actions in Latin America. Former Ecuadorian President Correa says that those going after Julian Assange want to discourage others from exposing war crimes. A Chinese spokesperson said that the Assange cases exposes the double standards in the U.S. on human rights and freedom of speech. Radio Havana, Cuba.
On Tuesday, the first secretary of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of Cuba and President of the Republic, Miguel Díaz-Canel, said in Havana that the U.S. lacks the moral authority to judge and decide on democracy. While delivering the conclusions of the 20th Alba Tsepe summit, the leader criticized the so-called democracy summit, called virtually and unilaterally by Washington. Díaz-Canel said that in that invitation, they turn a blind eye to the massacres and repression of social protests in Latin America, resulting in deaths and mutilated people. Nor was it possible to explain the 2019 coup d'etat in Bolivia, promoted by the administration of President Donald Trump, and which was celebrated by the then Secretary of State of that country. The Caribbean leader denounced the growing number of social leaders and journalists murdered in the continent without the White House batting an eyelid. He also wondered why the summit convened by the President Joseph Biden did not talk about investigating the right-wing politicians of several countries who hid their wealth in offshore accounts. The statesman assured that sanctions and other punitive measures will not be able to break the Cuban people, Venezuela and Nicaragua. He stressed that the Bolivarian Alliance for the Peoples of our America, People's Trade Agreement, ALBA DCP, will work for the dignity and happiness of its people. In this regard, he reiterated Cuba's solidarity commitment that puts its vaccines and other vaccine candidates at the service of humanity, particularly the nations of Latin America and the Caribbean.
Rafael Correa, the former president of Ecuador, says that those going after Julian Assange want to discourage others from exposing war crimes. Correa claimed, quote, "This prosecution is a total sham." Noting that the decision was announced on December the 10th, Correa said during an interview with the TV media channel RT, quote, "It's such a paradox. On International Human Rights Day, a tremendous attack was launched on the human rights of a journalist for the crime of having told the truth." Dismissing the case against Assange as, quote, "total hypocrisy," Correa said, quote, "War criminals are persecuted, the one who denounced them. If Assange had exposed the secrets of China, Russia, or any left-wing Latin American government, including my own, he would have been praised by the international press, honored by the U.S. Congress and the British Parliament. But because his actions were against the interests of the United States, the hegemonic country, he has been labeled a criminal." Correa said that the goal of the prosecution was to scare others so that, quote, "nobody else dares to denounce the secrets of great powers." He insisted that war crimes should not be treated as protected state secrets. Quote, "the whole world must know about them. Such crimes should not go unpublished." After a UK High Court approved the extradition of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, Wang Wenbin, Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson, speaking at a press conference on Assange's extradition to the United States, where he has been indicted on 17 charges of espionage and one charge of computer misuse, said that the Assange case exposes the double standards of the US on the issue of human rights and that of freedom of speech. Wenbin asserted, quote, "it seems that anyone can enjoy freedom of the press as long as they refrain from criticizing or disclosing the unspeakable crimes committed by the U.S. Otherwise, they may end up behind bars like Mr. Assange." The U.S. government that had challenged a decision made in January against his extradition won an appeal at Britain's High Court last Friday. Assange is accused of the release of vast troves of confidential U.S. military records, including classified diplomatic and military files in 2010, about U.S. bombing campaigns in Afghanistan and Iraq that proved highly embarrassing for Washington. The British High Court ruling once again can be seen as illustrating the aligned foreign policy of the US and the UK and their cozy relationship in suppressing the freedom of speech.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website is working well at radiohc.cu, though the podcasts are not updated. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140, and from 5 p.m. to 11 at either 6000, 6060, or 6100. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows. Please consider making a safe donation online through PayPal. There's a link at my website along with the podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 25th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. The Shortwave Report is produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.